Turning the pages of the precious book that is life, Pope Francis leads us along a path made of emotions, joys, and agonies, a window on the past that will allow us to better understand the present. Life, My Story Through History by Pope Francis is available now wherever books are sold, or get the audiobook, narrated by Stephen Colbert and Father John Quigley, wherever you like to listen.
Catholics all the way up to the Pope are concerned about young priests, and they're asking what changes need to be made to seminaries to better prepare priests for real-life ministry.
There was a few paragraphs where he spoke in an exceedingly harsh way about young priests of a more conservative bent.
The October 2023 Synod on Synodality expressed concern about formalism and ideology that lead to authoritarian attitudes in ordained ministers. For Catholics in the pews, these young priests seem to have a sense of superiority, a rigidity, or a way of looking at the church as black and white. The Synod also called for a global consultation on priestly formation and synodal leadership before the next Synod Assembly in October 2024. But in our reporting...
Do you know anything about how it's progressing?
I do not know how that's progressing.
That's the only hesitation I had about this interview. I've heard nothing.
Have you heard anything about this starting?
I haven't, no.
No, I haven't had anything particular.
We found no such consultation in effect. What we can report is that the Congregation for Clergy has scheduled a meeting on the topic, but facilitating a global consultation will inevitably take a long time. Still, the Synod's concerns about seminaries struck a chord. In this special deep dive episode of Inside the Vatican, we're pulling the curtain back on a critical part of the church that has a huge impact on Catholics, but that few of us ever see up close. How priests are formed.
It's a more intense moving away from the world on purpose, but it also is tough to not be engaged with the day-to-day faithful, normal human beings, if you will.
We'll hear from seminarians and the professionals responsible for shaping them about the challenges they're facing today.
We have young men who sometimes don't even know practical skills, how to balance a budget, how to do laundry, how to make their bed.
Anxiety, codependency, psychosexual issues, depression, and family of origin issues that just complicate all of those.
And about how seminary formation is already changing rapidly.
I think that the abuse crisis has brought about a greater vulnerability, a greater impetus to be honest in formation.
I'm like, praise God that we're doing this.
Along the way, we'll get a sense of how synodality is understood in seminaries and how it might be better cultivated. I'm Colleen Dully. This is Inside the Vatican. Before we get into our deep dive, a word from our sponsor. Do you want to be a master preacher? If so, Aquinas Institute of Theology's Doctor of Ministry and Preaching program will help you become the kind of preacher the church so desperately needs today. Grounded in the charism of the Order of Preachers, the Aquinas program is the only Catholic program of its kind in the United States, and its graduates hold leadership roles in preaching and teaching throughout the world. The Aquinas cohort model is designed to accommodate a full-time minister's busy schedule, including both in-person and virtual components, where students work together in a close-knit, supportive community. Applications are now being accepted for the 2024 cohort, which begins this summer. Visit ai.edu/DMIN for more information. That's ai.edu/DMIN. Now into our deep dive. So who is the typical man entering seminary today? To get a clear profile on seminarians, we turn to CARA, or the Center for Applied Research in the Apostolate at Georgetown University. CARA has been gathering reports profiling ordination classes for well over 25 years.
I'm Father Tom Gaunt. I'm a Jesuit member of the U.S. East Province, and my role at CARA is the executive director, where I've been here for the past 13 years.
Father Tom says that most men entering the seminaries are young, in their early 20s.
There was a period, probably in the 1980s, 90s, thereabouts, when there was a notable number of men entering seminaries who were into their mid-30s, 40s, 50 years of age. That grouping has declined, and by and large, overwhelmingly, the men entering the seminary each year are in their 20s, early 20s.
And like the rest of the U.S. church, the U.S. priesthood is increasingly foreign-born.
About a quarter of the men entering seminaries are foreign-born. And it's important to note that well over one quarter of all Catholics in the United States are foreign-born. And so this is kind of an ordinary, expected proportion in terms of the seminarians that would be coming, you know, from Mexico, from Brazil, from Nigeria, Kenya, from Vietnam, Korea, India. So it's a reflective group that way.
While the diversity of seminarians reflects the diversity of U.S. Catholics, there's still an immigration lag. So, for example, if there's an influx of immigrants from, say, Nigeria or Vietnam today, it will take roughly 10 years for us to see a rise in Nigerian or Vietnamese seminarians. And more men are joining the seminary after they receive a bachelor's degree, diversifying the educational backgrounds of today's priests.
We have degrees in business, in finance, in English literature, a whole variety of areas that I think ultimately is enriching to the church because you have kind of a richer education and experience for these future church leaders.
But when it comes to ideology, that is, the theology and ideas that shape a priest's self-understanding and ministry, seminaries are actually becoming less diverse. A 2023 report from the Catholic Project found a steady decline in the proportion of priests who described themselves as politically liberal and theologically progressive. Now, newly ordained priests overwhelmingly describe themselves as conservative.
I've been doing seminary work really for about 17 years now.
This is Father Josh Rodrigue from Notre Dame Seminary in New Orleans. He's the rector there, which means he runs the seminary under the authority of the local bishop.
So the times that I first started to where I'm at now, there's similarities, but there's differences too. And I think you do find a lot more traditional-minded seminarians because I think of the world, the way that we oftentimes hear more of a liberal or I guess you could say leftist type of approach to things, but it's almost a reaction to society.
Other seminary rectors are noticing this trend as well, including Father Paul Hazing. He's the rector at Kenrick Glennon Seminary in St. Louis.
Theologically, they also see the value in having some clear guidance from the church's teaching and that guidance that allows for the man to really thrive in his growth. I think if there's a lot of ambiguity, if there's a lot of gray, the men do shy away a bit. And so part of the work of our formation is to help the men learn how to live with ambiguity and gray in a way that's healthy because people live in gray. And so a man can be really theologically conservative and politically conservative and just a human mess. So it's getting them off of the safety nets and into the deeper water.
It's not just seminarians who struggle to see in shades of gray. Psychologists say that's a learning curve for most young adults.
If you get a pulse read on the young adult community in your local diocese, I think if you just pick out two or three men from there, that's the profile. They're just like every other young adult. My name is Maribel Rodriguez Laguna, and I am a licensed professional counselor supervisor, and I have a master's in counseling psychology.
And you're also a therapist to seminarians, right?
Right. I did not plan on it. I did not intentionally seek it out. It really actually was God that sought me out to do this work.
Maribel says that call came around the time that former Cardinal Theodore McCarrick's abuse of minors and seminarians became public.
Theodore McCarrick, the once powerful Catholic Church leader and Archbishop of Washington, was defrocked today. The Vatican making the announcement after finding McCarrick guilty of sex abuse, including with minors.
McCarrick rose through the ranks of the church despite claims he was sleeping with seminary students and young priests.
And specifically with the McCarrick case, I think it came out on a Saturday evening and I went to Mass that Sunday. I did not want to go. I said, well, I have to go. It was one of those moments where you choose to do the right thing even if you don't want to do the right thing. And I was reciting the creed through gritted teeth because I was so angry. I was so angry that here I am promising to believe this, and there are people in the church that are messing it up and hurting the hierarchy of the church, hurting the future of the church, hurting me in a very personal way. Because at the time, my brother was also a seminarian, and so it was very personal to me. And when I was praying through anger and all of that, I heard the voice of God say, "Will you heal my church?" To which I responded, I was like, "I believe that you're speaking to someone else." But as I sat with those words, I realized that God was calling me to help heal his brother priests and really kind of support their ability to protect the church, their bride.
When Maribel began consulting with seminaries, she discovered that the healing work wasn't necessarily about liberal or conservative ideologies, or even about the seminarians struggling with moral gray areas. It was about something much more foundational.
I think a lot of young adults have lacked human formation in their family of origin. Essentially, they're lacking parents teaching them how to be an adult. And some of it is because of the helicopter parenting fad. Now it's become snowplow parenting fad. And so let me differentiate. Helicopter parenting is like, oh, let me monitor everything that you're doing and making sure you're on the right track. Snowplow parenting is like, let me remove any discomfort and obstacle in your life so that you can be, quote unquote, a successful person. But then it doesn't teach individuals to tolerate discomfort, learn through the discomfort, and essentially build courage to face the discomfort and do something in the face of it. This creates a lot of problems. We have, you know, young men who sometimes don't even know practical skills, how to balance a budget, how to do laundry, how to make their bed. These are things that should have been taught by the parents, because the parents are the primary educators of the faith and of human aspects. And so with self-awareness, because they haven't had a lot of time to reflect, work through the discomfort of things, then they lack some insight as to why they do what they do. And again, some of this is developmentally appropriate, but the American Psychological Association just came out with something saying that now young adults are not fully adult until age 30.
So why has this focus on psychological development only recently become a priority for seminaries? In order to answer that, we have to look at how the church first became acquainted, albeit reluctantly, with the field of psychology.
The relationship between psychology and the Catholic faith has not always been amicable. There's a famous therapist that developed a certain type of therapy and would go and do group therapy in different religious orders because there was affirmation about what the individuals were bringing into the room. The clients of the group felt affirmed and encouraged to leave the order.
That famous therapist was Carl Rogers, considered by many the father of humanistic psychology. And while this story isn't single-handedly responsible for the tenuous relationship between the church and psychology over the last five decades, it can't be ignored.
I got interested in it because over the years, from time to time, a student would come into my office very concerned and wanting to let me know that humanistic psychology is detrimental to your faith. That, did you know that Carl Rogers, who is humanistic psychologist number one, ruined an order of nuns? And I had never heard the story. My name is Robert Kugelman, and I am a retired professor of psychology at the University of Dallas.
Robert began to look into the story, and the more he dug, the more interesting it became.
The Immaculate Heart of Mary nuns have been in California since 1871. And in the wake of the Second Vatican Council, religious orders were called to form, they called them chapters, to review their vocations and to make any adjustments that they had to make. And in the late 1960s, the Immaculate Heart Order was forming a chapter. And right around that time, they got wind of this project that Carl Rogers was involved with, in terms of how to reform education. And the nuns operated schools, high schools, and a college. It was Immaculate Heart College in Southern California. And so they were interested in what Carl Rogers may have to offer them. So Rogers, what he proposed was a series of encounter groups.
And what's an encounter group?
An encounter group is a form of psychological, interpersonal activity, and the focus is not on problem solving. The focus is on each individual being their authentic self. In an encounter group, you put aside all of your normal social roles. So if you're a young nun, you're there with your mother superior. During the encounter group, you're equals. And that was threatening to anybody who put a great stock in the religious institutions as they were at that time understood. Very quickly, there was some division that emerged within the order.
There was division in the religious order even before the sisters brought in Rogers and his team. There was long-standing tension with Cardinal McIntyre, then the Archbishop of Los Angeles.
And he told them that if they were not going to wear their traditional habits, they could not teach in his schools anymore. He had already had reason to call them on the carpet for other things, including being involved in civil rights activities. So there was ongoing conflict between the order and the cardinal. And the encounter group didn't help. As a result of unreconcilable relationships with the cardinal, about 300 of the nuns decided to leave the order.
That's out of how many?
About 350.
And so where did the nuns who left go?
They formed the Immaculate Heart community there in Los Angeles. They're still involved in things like civil rights and housing for the homeless and so on, all kinds of social issues. And there's still a community. So one of the, I guess, ironic things perhaps is that Carl Rogers is often accused of celebrating individuality and ignoring community. And the nuns never abandoned the importance of community.
So you talked at the beginning about these students who would come up to you and say, you know, humanistic psychology ruins your faith.
Right.
How would you respond to those students now, having done all this research into the story?
I tell them to get their facts straight. I think that Rogers' group played a role in what happened.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they didn't put a door jam in, you know, to stop anything happening. But I think their role was minor.
There have been many developments in this relationship between psychology and the church since the Carl Rogers scandal in the late 60s. For one, the field of psychology has matured. Now, positive psychology, which many consider to be the heir of humanistic psychology, is more compatible with the Catholic faith. Both have a shared appreciation of human virtue. In addition to this evolution in the field, the following decade saw a dramatic growth of psychology departments in Catholic universities. No longer was psychology the suspicious new kid on the block. It was a practice of Catholic priests and professors and firmly established among the sciences. So where do we see psychology showing up in seminaries today? Well, for starters, many seminarians are in therapy. In fact, therapy isn't regarded as a private practice. It's now built into the community life of seminaries.
I'm Nick Smith. I'm from Huntsville, Alabama. I'm in very north Alabama, close to the border of Tennessee.
At Notre Dame Seminary, Nick and other first-year students have group counseling sessions.
I don't want to speak for the other guys, but I think at least many of us look forward to that. It is an opportunity to kind of share difficult moments through the course of the week, especially specific struggles for recently new seminarians, such as, gosh, I don't know if I can make this commitment for my whole life. You know, gosh, I miss my old life. I kind of want to go back. Here's why. You know, sorts of things like that that we're all struggling with. And I can't tell you how frequently I've said something or somebody else said something and the rest of the class kind of went, yes, me too.
That kind of openness and vulnerability with guidance from trained counselors and therapists can start to help the men become more understanding of themselves and their classmates as people who struggle or fall short. and that's an important first step for a pastor. Here's Father Paul Hazing again.
In the beginning stage, you're going to look for a man who's growing in self-awareness, but he's coming out of self-preoccupation. Because he knows himself, he's able to pay attention to others more. So his relationality increases and his friendships deepen. So that's the propedeutic stage.
The propedeutic stage is a full year that's focused on what priestly formation experts call human formation. It's a fairly recent development in seminary formation. The propedutes, as they're called, live in a small community with one another, separate from the rest of the seminary, and they usually don't take classes for the first few months. Instead, they work on building some of the basic social skills that they're going to need to be a priest, in addition to basic life skills like making their bed or doing the laundry. And for therapists like Maribel, this is a much welcome development.
Oh, I am a big fan of the propedeutic year. What I was seeing is that I was having to teach a lot of these things in session, which is fine. That's part of my job. But I was wondering, why did they not get this, again, in their family of origin? And so what we were seeing is that men were making slower progress in therapy than we would like because we had to do a lot of groundwork. And so the propedeutic year is sort of an answer to the problem. Let's do the groundwork 1 year before they actually enter into seminary formation.
A lot of the year for the propedeute is detox.
Here's Father Paul Hazing again.
So our propedeutic men will have their phone for 4 hours on Saturday. The rest of the time, they have no phone, no computer, no media. They're reading, developing hobbies, doing things together, working together. We have manual labor. We do have them going out to the neighborhood, meeting our neighbors. So learning how to engage people conversationally. I mean, we're developing a social acumen with these men that we haven't seen in previous groups because they're so available humanly and personally because of that detox.
And that digital detox is much needed because the students entering seminary today have spent some of their most formative years online, in many cases seeing deeply divisive content about Catholicism.
There's little doubt that Pope Francis has been the most controversial pope of any of our lifetimes.
Are we more Catholic than the Pope? Who are you to judge? Well, more Catholic than the Pope. We probably all are at this point. God help
us. I'm at the point where I don't really know how we can deny that Pope Francis is at least promoting material heresy.
There's a great rebellion against God going right now in our culture, and it's also going on in our church.
I'm going to stay committed to Jesus Christ, the deposit of faith. I'm not going to say, let's go down the synodal path and change everything.
The rectors we talked to recognized this is a big problem. They call it alternative formation, or more sinisterly, shadow formation. A digital detox is one step in pushing against that. This initial propedeutic year is a relatively new thing. The Vatican issued a big reform of priestly formation in 2016. And the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops worked with the Holy See for several years after that to reform its own program of priestly formation. Their updated version finally came out in 2022. The changes in it, like the propedeutic year, only took effect this academic year, 2023-24. So Nick, who we introduced earlier, is in his seminary's first ever cohort of propedutes.
So one of the main ways in which I have been impacted by this year so far is through the guidance of formators, mentors here, especially through a spiritual director that we have. He's just been really helpful for me in pointing out areas where I need to grow, the direction that I need to take in terms of my prayer life, the spiritual side, and also virtue.
So far, the propedutes seem to be thriving. But remember, this is an entirely new approach to seminary formation. If we're looking for its effects in new priests, it won't be immediate, but the next decade or so will be telling. So after the propedeutic year, seminarians get started on what we ordinarily think of when we think of seminary, studying theology for 2 to 4 years in what's officially called the discipleship phase. Counseling and therapy remain available for those who seek it.
In discipleship, his self-awareness moves into some areas of weakness, and so he grows in self-acceptance.
After those few years, it's pretty clear that this man is going to be a priest. So he moves on to what's called the configuration stage, in which he studies graduate-level theology and starts learning some of the ministry skills he'll use as a priest, like preaching, celebrating the sacraments, and doing pastoral counseling.
in the configuration stage, the man really moves into self-possession. He knows who he is, and he's happy about who he is. He accepts his strengths and weaknesses in a peace and a serenity and a joy, and then he can give himself really generously.
And along the way, there are evaluations.
In these stages, we'll have evaluation 101, reflection from the man. We'll have all the professors involved, like how is he in the class? We have a round table with the counselors. They have certain things they want to focus on with certain men, and we want to pay attention to that together. So it's a community with various relationships that allow the man to employ the expertise of the church.
When the rector, with input from the professors and counselors and perhaps others, determines that the seminarian is ready, he'll be ordained a transitional deacon and enter the last phase, the vocational synthesis stage, or what's more commonly referred to as an internship or a pastoral year. That's when Catholics at a parish might meet a seminarian for the first time and hear him preach.
The men spend a whole year in the parish, the full year, under a pastor who is a supervisor but also a mentor. He knows how to teach what he does. And then a lay board, usually a principal of the grade school, the janitor, the director of education, just some all-star parishioners around the man to just give him a 360 every month. And so a very intensive internship experience has been absolutely essential for our formation. It's exposure.
Exposure. Priests need exposure to the real world, to the people they're going to be ministering to. But is exposure in tension with the traditional practice of retreating from the world to discern and pray? After the break, how the burgeoning culture of synodality in the Catholic Church could challenge the seminary at an even deeper level. Stay with us. Do you want to be a master preacher? If so, Aquinas Institute of Theology's Doctor of Ministry in Preaching program will help you become the kind of preacher the church so desperately needs today. Grounded in the charism of the Order of Preachers, the Aquinas program is the only Catholic program of its kind in the United States, and its graduates hold leadership roles in preaching and teaching throughout the world. The Aquinas cohort model is designed to accommodate a full-time minister's busy schedule, including both in-person and virtual components, where students work together in a close-knit, supportive community. Applications are now being accepted for the 2024 cohort, which begins this summer. Visit ai.edu/dmin for more information. That's ai.edu/dmin. Now back to our story.
Yesterday in the afternoon, there was the 18th General Congregation of the Synod, the presence of 438 members, and a debate was open, free debate on the project of the synthesis report, and as we know, also the Pope was present and he intervened.
Near the end of the Synod on Synodality last October, Pope Francis gave an unexpected and very strong speech denouncing clericalism. He called it, quote, a whip, a scourge, a form of worldliness that defiles and damages the face of the church, enslaving other Catholics. He talked about the sorrow and scandal that clericalism leads to, adding, it is enough to go into the ecclesiastical tailor shops in Rome and see the scandal of young priests trying on cassocks and hats or albs and lace robes. It was a statement that sent shockwaves through the synod, but it wasn't unprovoked. Here's Father Vimal Tirumanna, a synod member who spoke to me after the synod.
I remember that afternoon, it was a direct response to some of the interventions, some of the ways some people were talking. In fact, I was surprised and pleasantly surprised because that sort of a statement was very welcome. In fact, people applauded. Most of us applauded that.
Despite some objections, the synod as a whole voted overwhelmingly in favor of denouncing clericalism. It revealed, or confirmed, that this was a big concern across the church. And as for fixing it, the synod had some ideas. First, they want seminarians to remain connected to the daily life of the community. Formation, they said, should not create an artificial environment separate from the ordinary life of the faithful, and priests should have a significant, albeit initial, experience of life in a Christian community. Father Deogratius Asika, a professor at Notre Dame Seminary in New Orleans and a graduate of that same seminary, believes that this connection to the community must also extend to the poorest parishioners, even more than it does now, under the newest seminary reforms.
Many of our seminarians come from upper middle class families, and so they don't have that experience of poverty or of vulnerability, what Pope Francis is talking about, all the different people on the margins. Part of the formation should be required to have diverse experiences of the lives of the people that they are going to serve. So, being a parish and have an experience of the life of divorced and remarried parishioners, of same-sex couples, of immigrants, of poor people.
This is something we heard from New Orleans to New York.
Our men are going out to hospitals, nursing homes, rehab centers, psychological wards, homeless shelters, street ministry, prison ministry, and post-prison ministry. I'm Father Richard Veras. I'm a priest of the Archdiocese of New York, and I've been the director of pastoral formation and a teacher of homiletics here at St. Joseph Seminary. You know, when you're meeting people, when you're ministering to them, when you're just listening to them, I think a lot of that ideology and polarization goes away. It quickly takes a complete backseat to just being present there and to listening.
And it isn't only those on the margins who seminarians need to learn to work with. The Synod expressed a particular concern that there weren't enough women in seminaries, as teachers or as students. At Notre Dame Seminary, there have been women professors in the past, but right now they have none.
If they've come from an environment where they've only been taught by men, maybe they were at another seminary where all the faculty were men, I find sometimes they may have greater difficulty, you know, being open to our role as women.
This is Dr. Josephine Lombardi, Assistant Dean of St. Augustine's Seminary in Toronto, Canada, where there are several women who are full-time faculty.
I think if right from the get-go, they see a woman who's already in a position of leadership, a woman who has influence, who's respected by her colleagues, consulted by her colleagues, that sets the tone for a seminary.
The Synod also said that women's access to formation programs and theological study needs to be considerably expanded. This would not only benefit women, it would help solve for the problem of polarization that the Synod warned against by introducing a greater variety of perspectives in the seminary classroom. So, if the vices most affecting priestly formation are clericalism and polarization, what are the remedial virtues our church is most in need of today? Overwhelmingly, we've heard about the importance of exposure. Exposure to life outside the seminary walls, exposure to a diversity of people and ways of life, and decreasing exposure to toxic online spaces. Seminarians need that exposure, their rectors and professors say, to combat the kind of black and white thinking that's common among young people and that underlies so much of the polarization in the church and even the resistance to Pope Francis's pastoral move toward ministering to those who live in gray areas the church might have previously overlooked. We also know about the positive impact of psychological support for seminarians in helping them accept and embrace their own humanity, which in turn helps their relationships with others. But the Synod is inviting the church toward an even deeper kind of listening and understanding. Seminarians get training in pastoral counseling, helping their parishioners through problems. But that training doesn't necessarily extend to listening to parishioners' input on decisions that might affect them. And that mutual listening and empowering lay co-responsibility in the church is becoming a pillar of synodality.
Can you give me your definition of a synodal priest?
A synodal priest would be a discerning presence wherever he's sent. He welcomes input from everyone. He's eager to hear from everyone. And he discerns with the Holy Spirit and with the heart of the church on his next steps, his actions. And he's doing it with the people, not against or making stands on his own. He's really moving the people along with the church and not trying to force an agenda. So I'd say he's a listener and he's a discerner par excellence.
To that end, some synod members noted that for synodality to succeed, it's not enough for the church to criticize clericalism. It must develop a new synodal identity for diocesan priests. Father Timothy Radcliffe, the Dominican priest who served as one of the synod's spiritual directors, put it this way in a press briefing at the end of the synod.
A constant theme of this synod, and going back to the beginning of Pope Francis's time as Pope, has been a critique of clericalism. And I think many diocesan priests have found this alarming, because it does seem to undermine a fundamental element of their identity. So I think what we have to do, what the church has to do, is also find a way of sharing a positive view of the diocesan priesthood, of how belonging to the diocesan priesthood is something beautiful and wonderful, fraternal. Once you have that, then I think many more priests will be happy to come on board with the synodal process. But you cannot expect them to do that unless they have a feeling that their vocation is cherished.
It remains unclear how such a development will happen, but the Synod's hope is that seminaries become schools of synodality, not just for aspiring priests, but for the whole church. The Catholic Church has undergone a lot of change, especially since the Second Vatican Council in the 1960s. Its relationship with psychology has improved, as psychology itself has evolved. But perhaps no church institution has faced as much change as quickly as seminaries, especially in the 11 years of Francis' papacy. Even though the most recent program of priestly formation was just implemented in the United States, it won't be the standard for long. The urgency with which the Synod, together with Pope Francis, is calling for a renewal of formation can't be ignored. Exactly what that formation will look like in North America is yet to be seen. But the holy, faithful people of God, as Pope Francis says, have made their voices heard. They expect their priests to not only teach, but to listen, to be collaborative and pastorally sensitive, and not formalistic or authoritarian. Seminaries, already places of major recent changes, will be at the forefront of the Catholic Church's transformation into a synodal community. Are they ready to answer the call? Inside the Vatican is a production of America Media. This deep dive episode was produced by Maggie Van Dorn and me. Our executive producer is Sebastian Gomes. Production assistance from Delaney Coyne and Kevin Christopher Robles. Audio engineering by Frank Tucson. If you're a fan of Inside the Vatican deep dives, you will love all the other smart Catholic resources from America Magazine. Every day, you can find the best in Catholic media from America. Whether it's the daily scripture reflections from me and my thoughtful colleagues, the Vatican analysis, or culture reviews from a Catholic perspective, you need to be reading America for a well-rounded Catholic point of view. And there's never been a better time to try it. You can get a subscription to America for just $1 for your first month. Or if you already have one, help us spread the word and give one to your friends. To take advantage of this $1 offer, visit americamagazine.org/trial or click the link in the show notes. For America Media, I'm your host and producer, Colleen Deli. We'll see you next time.